Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an absolutely amazing individual, Tom Hodgkinson, the British writer and editor of The Idler. Now, normally for these podcasts, I've been going through things like everyone's sort of LinkedIn profiles or whatever. But obviously, being from The Idler, Tom doesn't stoop to such a sort of platform. So I managed to sort of just track down info about him online. So just to cover that off before we get going, from the point of view of his philosophy and his published books and articles, he has a relaxed approach to life, enjoying it as it comes rather than toiling for an imagined better future. The Idler was originally a series of essays, obviously written by Dr. Johnson from 1758 to 1760, for all you trivia fans. From the point of view of Tom, he's educated at Westminster, Jesus College, Cambridge, during which time he played the bass guitar in the Stupids influenced thrash band Chopper. Obviously, the Stupids, who can forget their sort of Peel sessions or the epic album Retard Picnic. After that, he went off to work at Rough Trade Records, of course, after which he began to import absinthe. Obviously, he then became a joint head of creative development at The Guardian. Then he launched also The Crap Towns, a series of books, The Mighty Crap Towns. Looking at a couple of those just before we started this, I saw that in the sort of a final lot that they put out, I think Peterborough won the sort of a top, or perhaps one should say bottom, somewhat on the Crap Towns list, with residents condemning it as backward and miserable. As the guide said, if booking a weekend getaway in Peterborough, it's customary that if a stranger holds eye contact with you for more than 3 seconds to shout what and become extremely aggressive. So in 2006, moving swiftly on, Tom created the National Unawareness Day to be celebrated on the November the 1st. And along with his partner, the brilliant Victoria Hull, he launched Idler Academy in London, a school that runs courses in a whole array of areas, including sort of philosophy, grammar, singing, drawing, calligraphy, astronomy, foraging, bread baking, and advice to small businesses. Finally, the Freedom Manifesto, how to free yourself from anxiety, fear, mortgages, money, guilt, debt, government, boredom, supermarkets, bills, melancholy, pain, depression, work, and waste came out a few years ago, and it is absolutely superb. So, after that, Tom, how are you?
Not too bad, thank you, Sean. We've actually been quite enjoying lockdown. It's in some ways, it's been a sort of gift to idling and the idea of being an idler. I think it's the first time ever, probably, that our government told us to do nothing. Generally, governments are very busy telling us to work harder, to get up early in the morning and scrape the ice off the car window before working all the hours that God gives. Give our children the best start in life, and so on and so forth. You know, it's called the work ethic. But for sort of 3 months, you know, suddenly it was like stay in bed, go stay at home, don't do anything, don't work, don't go out. So idlers, I think, were sort of making the most of it. It had the effect for Victoria and me of making us sort of double busy, unfortunately, but you know, that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember reading, I think, an issue that came out just after the whole thing got going that also actually mentioned that your brother actually got it, didn't he? He had COVID.
My brother, his name is Will Hodgkinson, and he's the pop critic at The Times. So we've ended up in very sort of similar worlds. Our parents were journalists and book writers, or still are. They're in their 70s now. Yeah. And Will got coronavirus, and he was going to write about it for The Times, where he's the pop critic. But they said, well, you're not really the coronavirus critic, so we're not really interested. So I was like, oh, please write about it for The Idler. And we popped it online as a sort of a blog, and it was really well received. So then we made it the cover story on the issue of The Idler that came out at the beginning of lockdown. And it's a lovely piece. I mean, you know, he basically says you've got to stop panic makes it much, much worse. So really the thing to do is to do nothing, you know, to lie in bed, to concentrate on your breathing, and to sort of desist from unnecessary activity.
Yeah. Just man, I loved it, by the way, in the latest issue, in terms of sort of the reality of actually what's been going on and all the rest of it. That was a great, great piece that brilliant Sally Phillips, mentioned when she says that, you in fact interviewed her. So therefore I'll quote your own words sort of back to you. So when you'd asked her, had she been keeping sane? She said, I haven't been keeping sane at all. The truth, a comedian tweeted last week, I've used lockdown to write a novel. Sorry, did I say novel? I meant this tweet. People just doing nothing.
Yeah. People resisted this pressure to write a novel or take up a new skill during lockdown, didn't they? There was a sort of gag about the sort of pressure to learn how to bake bread and sing and so on and so forth. You know, in order to write a novel is to be resisted. But at the same time, you know, lots of people did enjoy those sorts of things, and I think you can see when governments and certainly the Tories produce anti-idler manifestos, which they do fairly regularly and have done for about 200 years, they say idleness finds work, the devil finds work for idle hands to do. You know, in other words, if people aren't kept rather busy and distracted, then they'll either turn to crime or just sit around doing nothing, drinking beer in their underpants. But actually, the reality is, you know, people were given this, in a way, idleness. Okay, it was forced on them. It wasn't exactly voluntary. And they did all sorts of things. I mean, the two most widely reported, I think, were DIY and gardening. So, you know, our neighbours were getting on with doing up the house, and the gardens of England are now looking gorgeous. People actually did write poetry. I'm not saying it's good poetry, but they did. What's wrong with that? And people voluntarily helped each other. It's mutual aid. You know, when people are left alone and you have a bit of time, actually, you're not exhausted by your job. Human beings very naturally start to form groups and collectives and help the people in their community out who need help with grocery deliveries or whatever it might be. And so a lot of the, you know, sort of, I suppose, slightly political aspects of the idler, which encourage this sort of behaviour, mutual aid and spontaneous self-organisation of communities rather than a sort of submission to authority. Those sorts of things happened, and that was very heartening too. So it does make you think, well, yeah, I mean, idleness is good. And, you know, the effect on the planet was fantastic. Because, of course, it's activity that causes global warming. If you just lie on your back on the grass in your garden doing nothing all day, then you harm nobody and you use up no resources and you certainly don't use up any fossil fuels. But we're all encouraged to, you know, sort of rush around, jump on aeroplanes, you know, go on holiday, commute to the office. The whole modern world is about movement and feeding the economy, getting the economy moving again, this sort of thing. That is directly what causes pollution. So, you know, we noticed right at the beginning of lockdown, I think everybody did, over Wuhan province, there was, you know, some people took one of those aerial photographs which detect pollution, and it has suddenly sort of vanished, you know. So that was also very positive, I think. Well, Sally Phillips is right, you know, she felt there was this sort of pressure to, you know, reading the collected works of Proust and, you know, Dickens and write a novel. Well, if you don't have to do those things, you know, but people certainly did very, very, very naturally get into the garden, help each other out, do up the house and spend more time with the family too. And, you know, for a lot of people, quality of life improved.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. It's interesting that you make that point about looking at it from a sort of, you know, maybe say political point of view, certainly sort of party political point of view. I mean, to the people I know that, I mean, there's that great quote that you put in there about Priti Patel recently, the Home Secretary, when you say that she'd accuse the British of being the worst idlers in the world. But as you've said, by worst, presumably she means the best.
Fantastic. Yeah, that was, there's a sort of coterie of these very right-wing MPs, many of whom are in the cabinet now. Dominic Raab is another one.
Yeah, yeah.
And Priti Patel, I forget the other two, but the four of them got together and wrote this rather sort of grim, grad-grindian, utilitarian manifesto for kind of self-improvement, where they sort of criticised British workers for being lazy. And they said, you know, we've got to work harder. English people, when just like football and pop music, you know, we should be more like Asian people who work sort of like 24/7. You know, I mean, people in China and India have a sort of really, it's a very sort of competitive society, actually. I mean, in Indians are very likely to overwork. And we know about the tiger mothers in Asian cultures. You know, and so, yes, there's something obviously to be said for that. But Priti Patel is basically saying, pop music and football are a waste of time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was another MP as well, like he was criticising the idea of the basic income. He's not an MP anymore, I don't think, Nick Bowles.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
And he said, you know, I have a moral objection to the citizens' income because people just sit around doing nothing and, you know, life is all about hard work, we're hardwired to work and so on. So, you know, it's when you look at it through that prism, you can actually see that. It's on the left as well, I have to say. You know, Gordon Brown was extremely hardworking himself personally. He was a Presbyterian, basically a sort of a Puritan, a Scottish hardworking Puritan. They don't smile, they work hard, they don't like dancing around the maypole, they don't like Christmas, they don't like having fun, they don't like drinking. You know, cause let's work really, really hard. They got that kind of quite hard face. That's quite a, you know, he's in a tradition there that goes back. Probably to the sort of early 17th century or even earlier. It's not just the right wing who are pro-work, the left wing are very pro-work as well. And obviously the extreme left, the communists were all about work. But the Tories are as well. So it's not just the Tories who have this sort of view of the world. It's basically politicians. They're all sort of more or less utilitarians, I think. I think they forget, they leave out this whole other part of life, which is what we might call the romantic part. You know, you can't quantify it. It's about dreaming and wandering through the woods and doing stuff that you enjoy for its own sake with your friends. We all do these things, you know, parties, holidays, and that's the sort of part of life that I think is actually more important than, you know, possibly the stuff you do just to earn money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's that great. You've got a quote in there, one of the issues from Bob Dylan saying that, you know, if a man gets up in the morning and goes to bed at night and does what he chooses in between, I would consider him a success. And then it's also in that issue, again, quoting your own stuff back at you, that near to a piece that Tim Richardson had written about Blake, there's a sort of an almost sort of, as an ad agency would put it, a sort of a reason to believe that you guys have put out that said, basically, down with Silicon Valley, bake bread, play the ukulele, open the village hall, action is futile, quit moaning, make music, stop consuming, start producing, back to the land, smash usury, embrace beauty, embrace poverty, hail the chisel, ignore the state, reform is futile, anarchy in the UK, hail the spade, hail the horse, hail the quill, love thy neighbour, be creative, free your spirit, dig the earth, make compost, life is absurd, we are free, be merry. Wow, that is amazing.
Well, that was actually the idea of my publisher at Penguin. I wrote a book, you mentioned it, called The Freedom Manifesto.
Yeah, yeah.
And before that, I wrote a book called How to Be Idle. And when that was being published, he said, you should write a manifesto for this. And I sort of, so I did that for How to Be Idle. And I guess sort of knocked it off in a sort of, in a sort of stream of consciousness. But I think I was sort of half thinking of things like the Futurist Manifesto and
yeah, yeah,
those sort of 1920s surrealist movement, Dada and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then we thought, well, that was quite fun. We did the Idler Manifesto. So when the How to Be Free or Freedom Manifesto book was published, he decided to do something similar. And we got our designers to typeset it into a poster, which actually you can get free on our website and stick up on the wall. But, you know, I wrote that about 10 or 15 years ago, but it's it seems more relevant even actually now you sort of read it back.
Yeah, doesn't it? I mean, it's just perfect.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could take issue. I mean, people take issue with some of them. Embrace poverty sounds a bit sort of, perhaps a bit sort of tactless. Mm-hmm. What I was trying to say was, you know, embrace poverty, and it's a sort of an idea. St. Francis of Assisi, you know, throughout all his worldly possessions and lived in a cave, and, you know, Diogenes, the Cynic philosopher, you know, did something similar. Gandhi, you know, it's like not that we all have to do that. And anyone who's been poor and in debt knows that it's not a state to be embraced at all. It's pretty awful. But, you know, but as a sort of spiritual idea, it's in Christianity. It's in most religions, actually. So it shouldn't really be such a controversial thing to say. But by that I don't mean that it's somehow sort of wonderful to be on the breadline or on the dole and in debt. Not at all.
Yeah. And on that point about the cynics and religion, sort of that when you interviewed Rowan Williams, the older, or as we say, the ex sort of Archbishop of Canterbury, I thought it was great that when the interview started off, you thought that he was a big Bowie fan because you found some Bowie stuff in his study, but it actually wasn't it at all. But you said that he was incredibly bright.
Yeah, he's he's like a sort of, I don't know how to describe him. I mean, he's quite grand, but he's not scary in the slightest. He is extremely composed, extremely polite, but he's just so learned. I actually tried to read one of his books about Dostoevsky. I mean, he learned Russian in order to read Dostoevsky.
Oh yeah, you mentioned in the piece. Yeah.
I mean, incredible. Things like this, you know, it's absolutely amazing. And you know, he's considered in some circles, particularly on the East Coast in America, in places like Boston, among some of the Christians there, as a sort of saintly figure, because he was Archbishop of Canterbury. But he's a real intellectual, you get the feeling you could just mention any subject, and he would come back with a sort of learned, considered reply or answer. And that's in fact what he did with, you know, we talked about Greek philosophy, Socrates, and so on. And went through to the present day. But yes, disappointingly, it turns out he wasn't a Bowie fan. But he was a fan of Bertie Wooster. And this is sort of how his mind works. And he saw in Bertie Wooster, you know, he's a wonderful character, very popular. And he saw Bertie Wooster in Jeeves as being a sort of like a holy fool. Which is a recurring theme in Dostoevsky, actually. There's a book called The Idiot. This sort of like innocent in the middle of a sort of corrupt world who sort of bumbles along, but actually he sort of sees things more clearly than other people because he's not sort of tied up in it, you know. And in fact, you know, there are characters like that in Evelyn Waugh as well. There's this sort of Paul Pennyfeather, who's this sort of, you know, not a idiot by any means, but he's a sort of, you know, sort of slightly naive, straightforward character, surrounded by all these insane and more or less sort of corrupt individuals. So I think you saw in Bertie Wooster something of that. But what I mean is, you know, he can go. Rowan Williams can go from talking about Socrates to Bertie Wooster to Dostoevsky, you know, in a blink, and make it all sound, you know, pretty accessible. I mean, one of the sub editors who read the piece said, wow, it's actually quite hard to follow. I mean, you might need to read it a second time. But if you do read it a second time, it's pretty clear, I think, or I hope so.
Yeah, exactly. And he didn't mention was obviously Iggy Pop when I was talking about The Idiot. But to go back to...
I'm sure he would be a fan of...
Well, yeah, exactly, he would.
For the same reasons, yeah.
Exactly. I remember years ago, a friend of mine was in a really sort of crap fish and chip shop in Minehead in Somerset before Somerset became obviously overrun by hideous people from London. And so on like a sort of Tuesday night, in a rainy sort of thing, he just turned around and there's a really sort of skinny bloke with long hair next to him. And he said, "Really, you look like Iggy Pop." And it was Iggy Pop. And it's a whole thing about why did Iggy Pop end up in a chip shop in Minehead on a Tuesday night? And obviously, because they were doing sort of the first of the ironic excellent festivals in Butlins nearby. But very good.
I didn't grow up in Minehead, but my granny and grandfather retired to Minehead. So I used to go there all the time.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
And yeah, I got sort of. Well, sort of a mixture of memories. We had lots of fish and chips, and we used to play games like sort of Space Invaders in the arcades.
Fantastic. Classic and, Space Invaders.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And Gorf, I don't even remember that one.
No.
And Boot Hill and things like this.
Very good.
But I didn't know that it had become sort of hip and that Iggy Pop had gone.
Obviously, I mean, when they first did it, I think they had a festival in Butlins, obviously All Tomorrow's Parties, organised by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, which was like at that point ground zero in terms of being the finest thing that one could possibly do. But then I think it's now, over the last few years, become a bit more obvious, but one of those. But going back slightly, when you're talking earlier about utilitarianism and all the rest of it, that issue or the interview that you did with the mighty Paul Mason, I thought was really interesting when he was talking about at that point his sort of a next book, Clear Bright Future, and talked about the four main ethical systems in terms of utilitarianism, and then the issue of to put it politely, the FU to Silicon Valley, and then ethics around sort of social justice, and then virtue from the point of view of the sort of the Aristotle angle, which you mentioned there was probably nearest to the Idler.
Sean, by the way, thanks for reading the magazine so carefully. It's
of course
it's nice to hear that people have actually read what we've done, because you get readers' letters, obviously. But they rarely discuss a sort of particular piece, so you sort of wonder whether people are reading it. But Paul Mason's great. I was quite surprised. He's a sort of like sort of a Marxist basically.
Mm.
But it's not just Marxist. He's got his own sort of take on things. The second book that he did, he talked about Aristotle and ethics and large companies. He's very sophisticated in his understanding of economics, and he was the economics correspondent, I think, on Channel 4 News.
And then before that, Newsnight, where he was.
He's got a very sort of sharp brain and that sort of thing, which most of us don't have. I mean, I sort of go around in a bit of a muddle on questions of economics.
Join the club.
Yeah, it's nice to read it from that point of view. But yeah, I thought that was quite a wonderful bit that wasn't spoken about, I don't think, by many reviewers, was that he praised Aristotle, because Aristotle invented, well, it came to be known as a sort of system of ethics called virtue ethics, which is basically about being sort of good, And he contrasted that with, as you said, the FU ethics of Silicon Valley, which would be something like the FU ethics of someone like, Elon Musk there was a group of them who started PayPal, and one was called Peter Thiel. There's a whole gang, they're called the PayPal Mafia, that when they were quite young, they started and sold PayPal, which was a sort of money transfer system where they charged 4% per transaction. So it's like a license to print money. They all made massive fortunes. Peter Thiel invested his fortune in a small company called Facebook, and millions of other things, and he's absolutely loaded. But they have this sort of libertarian. The ultimate example will probably be the guy who started Uber, Travis.
And they
have a particular philosophy, which is like, if you're poor, that's your fault. You've got to take responsibility for the disasters that have happened to you. If you work hard in this country, then you can do very well. It's an American idea, and also if you become rich, that's kind of a sign that God has blessed you. Not that you're just incredibly greedy and have no morals at all.
Yeah, precisely.
Because how I see it, and they like Ayn Rand, and it's a libertarian philosophy. And so I don't suppose they've even heard of Aristotle, and they probably think those Greeks are like some old guys. So it's really good to see a progressive political thinker like Paul Mason. And also other people on the left probably think that that's all old hat, and you've got to think about new stuff. You know, communists were sort of famously, let's start from zero. So I thought it was great to see that Paul Mason's got this sort of historical perspective, and that he was, you know, he said large companies, corporations should employ modern day Aristotles.
Yeah, completely.
To sort of like, you know, have an ethical board which guide their decisions. A bit like in Islam, you know, you get these clerics who sort of advise large Islamic concerns on, you know, what is and what isn't ethical. I mean, obviously they jump through a lot of hoops sometimes, but at least the sort of basic principle is there. Actually, as it was in medieval Christianity, because although there was lots of business activity, there was early forms of banking and all sorts of things, but you know, the head of the Medicis would be going for long walks with the principal monk, you know, like Savonarola or whoever it might be, to discuss ethics. And the Christians, you know, obviously Christianity was massive then, like, they controlled everything. Yeah. And so, that was another bit in the manifesto, smash usury. What do I mean by that? Well, it's just interesting that before the Reformation, the Christian clerics had more or less banned charging interest on loans, certainly to small people. I mean, among businesses, it was okay. But, something like a wonga, you know, money lenders were sort of seen as sort of basically evil because they charged interest on loans. They took advantage of people's poverty. And, you know, for the Christians, you know, in Silicon Valley, if you're on the street, it's your fault. Someone else can look up, can lift you up. And, you know, if you're too kind of thick or lazy to take advantage of wonderful America, then, you know, you got what's coming to you. But Christians had, certainly before the Reformation, had a different view, which was that, you know, we don't actually have that much control over our everyday lives. You can sort of do well and stuff, but there's a lot of luck and faith involved. So someone who's very poor, homeless, is a leper, you know, that's really bad luck. And you're just lucky, you know, that if you're rich. And so you should really be helping each other out. So it was wrong to take advantage, they thought, of someone's poverty by lending them money on which you then charged interest, you know. So I think Wonga collapsed, but there are these payday lenders today, that's the equivalent. And so they, you know, you're absolutely desperate for cash. So you borrow £100 and you have to pay back £120 like a week later, which is like a crazy rate of interest, you know. But because you're too poor and under the radar to get credit in any other way. Anyway, so the point being that, so Paul Mason's an interesting guy because he sort of brings some of these ideas back into political thinking, whereas political thinking is actually dominated by, as I said, this sort of utilitarian philosophy, where it's just all about numbers and money.
No, I couldn't agree more. And that angle of having a sort of an in-house philosopher, or whatever, or taking leads from them is something actually I mentioned, have to say, in my first book, The Post-Truth Business, where I talked about, I mean, at that point, people like the Social Market Foundation, they did a lot about this. So the idea of, you know, then linking it to sort of brand behavior, you know, so instead of Aristotle, virtuous person does virtuous things for virtuous reasons. You can clear examples of decent brands doing that, or brands taking a sort of a niche approach, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the only worry about that sort of thing is that it becomes a sort of a fig leaf. So, you know,
very much so.
Nike could have a sort of, I don't know, just pluck an example out of my mind. Nike could say, oh, look, we've got a diversity committee. Or they could say, yeah, we gave all our employees access to a mindfulness app. So that we're done. now we can carry on exploiting people all over the world and, you know,
precisely,
sort of overcharging for sort of crap fashion and so on.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember I was writing about that a couple of years ago, that when they did the Colin Kaepernick ad, first of all, which was the first sort of, you know, major brand to get behind the whole Colin Kaepernick issue, that obviously then was very much linked in what is now the whole Black Lives Matter sort of a campaign that was, and movement that was all about. At the time, talking about sort of, you know, taking a sort of Jean-Jacques Rousseau approach, so saying basically it was something they did for passionate reasons, and they didn't overthink it, they didn't sort of, you know, dwell in it there for a long time to try and rationalize it. Was it right from the business point of view? They just did the right thing based on gut feeling, which is very, very unusual for a brand, particularly like them, that years ago, when I remember writing about stuff with Naomi Klein, you know, that, you know, had obviously been absolutely nailed, as they should have been, for all the third world sweatshop activity that they were absolutely all about, which they then rather try to sort of sort out. So, yeah, I mean, the amount of brands, yeah, doing the whole fig leaf brand purpose thing is absolutely outrageous. And it's great when you see the occasional ones that really do live really it, like Patagonia, and you think, fair enough. But moving on, someone
that
Patagonia, thinks...
Yeah, Patagonia, fair enough, yeah. But then, you know, but Boohoo's, which looked unstoppable about a week ago, is now looking a bit sort of dodgy as far as its ethics go.
Completely. Someone who, basically moving on from Aristotle, the next person you have to mention after Aristotle, obviously, is the mighty Jason Williamson from the Sleaford Mods, who you also interviewed. He'd have something to say about that. So what was it? I mean, I've seen them a few times. What a great band. But so what was the mighty Mr. Williamson like?
Yeah, he was really sweet. He was quite shy, actually. He spoke very well. There are a couple of gentlemen, you know. I haven't met Andrew, the other one. On stage, he looks like a sort of a sub Bez character.
It's fantastic.
Like he's going to like punch you in the face and like, you know, sell you drugs or something.
Yeah.
When you hear him talk, he's quite camp, and he's a bit like some Oscar Wilde. Well, yeah. So we thought that was a wonderful album, actually. Yeah. So, it was one of our finest moments. So thank you so much for coming. It's very good to meet you, and good luck with your magazine. You know, it's like they're like that, and it's almost a sort of a performance, I think, with Jason Williamson.
Apparently,
he's been like that. I mean, he's been in bands since he was like, you know, he was a mod in the '90s. He was in
Venice.
I've got one or two mutual friends who remember him, and they say he was always a real entertaining character. And, you know, doesn't care what he says. And I think the Sleaford Mod story is amazing. I mean, it's so unlikely for a sort of, you know, he's sort of like, I mean, he's 50 or something. Mm. You know, they're like a couple of middle-aged men, like, shouting on stage.
Oh, completely.
How did that get successful? And it's partly because he just gave up trying to please anybody. And he said, look, I just want to be like the Wu-Tang Clan. Andrew, do this sort of music. And they just got on with it. And we interviewed them a few... typesetter for The Idler, Christian Brett, who's more of a typesetter than a graphic designer.
He sets
the words. And then we have another person, the art director, who sort of decorates it. But he did the Sleaford Mods books. He put the lyrics into books and was a big fan of their lyrics.
Very good. The unprintable lyrics.
And so he got me into them in the first place. I've been sort of following them since then. But yeah, he was a lovely chap, and he followed up and he said, you know, he gets very, very sort of polite. His wife is lovely. She sort of seems to be the manager. She organized it all. And I think he doesn't drink anymore, you know, but he's obviously a bit damaged. Like, you know, he's got this sort of addictive personality, going on benders. And as he says in the interview, he sort of blamed Oasis.
Oh, yeah, he lives on a loathing of Noel Gallagher, doesn't he? There's a great quote. I was going to say, there's a great quote in there. And he goes, you know, I really enjoyed working at Little Chef. I wasn't hygienic at all. I was drunk behind the counter. It was a free-for-all.
Yeah, you had all these jobs at Little Chef and working in retail and, you know, because, like he says, he's a mod. He wants to have a bit of money in his pocket so he can have a proper haircut and buy some nice clothes. You know, he's not a... obviously he's not a hippie. He doesn't look anything like a hippie. But, you know, he's not actually a punk. He's more like Paul Weller than Johnny Rotten, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And he mentions Weller a lot, doesn't he? The mighty Weller.
He used to hate Weller, yeah.
Yeah.
He obviously hates people who, you know, I mean, he's a classic example of, you know, people hate the thing that they see in themselves reflected back at them, sort of thing. You know, if he wants to do a psychology on him. I just thought it was funny that he sort of managed to blame Oasis for an entire generation of men taking cocaine and losing their jobs and their wives and their families and becoming alcoholics. Maybe there's some truth in that. I guess it was an interesting idea. It hadn't really occurred to me before.
Yeah, well, maybe there is. But also, I mean, in terms of industrial drug usage, obviously Damien Hirst, I thought that was a really really interesting interview with him. He's talking about the whole sort of YBA movement and all the rest of it. And he talks about obviously staggering around Soho in the sort of loitering around the Colony Room up to no good, and then sorting himself out, becoming as clean as certainly Damien Hirst could be.
I think he's sort of addicted to work now. You know, he's got an addictive personality. And we used to bump into him in the 90s in, you know, up and down Dean Street. And I mean, he's really wild. I was just amazed that he...
he's alive.
And also was so massively successful at the same time, you know. But somehow they almost sort of fed each other. He's really absolutely fascinating person, but he's actually got a free spirit. And I think that's what really actually people respond to that in work. And as you said, he's incredibly confident and bold. He does these things on a massive scale. It's like someone said to me, it's like Pink Floyd, like with kind of helicopters or aeroplanes over the stage. You know, he's absolutely massively ambitious. And he says in the interview, that people think too small. You've got to think really, 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 really big. And his audience is rich people, obviously. He was roundly, you know, that interview, we put a little bit of it online. We don't put all the magazine online. We just put two or three short extracts from each issue because we want people to actually buy it by the thing. But we put a little extract of the interview online, and it circulated all over the place. But it was reported in the Daily Mail, but everyone was saying, "Oh, what an idiot!" You know, because if you took bits out of context, it sounded self-pitching. What happened to him was that I remember interviewing him in 1995, and he said, "My business model is the Beatles." I thought that was a lovely comment because he was saying, you know, I do want to be rich, but I want to be sort of cool at the same time and like bring this sort of joy into people's lives. But it came a little bit too true because he had his own Apple Records experience. Which is like, you know, this is the quote that went everywhere. He said, you know, first you get an assistant, and then the assistant's got an assistant. They got an Uber account. Then you got a lyre player in the court. You got a biographer. You got jugglers, and you got like minstrels. And you know, he's like suddenly you're this sort of king in the middle of all these courtiers. And that's definitely true. He had a lot of courtiers, and all this money was sort of flying out the window. And he said it was all fine while things were growing. So each year they were making more and more money, like absolutely massive amounts of money. But when the growth stopped and one year he made less money, all the holes were exposed in the business and they had to sack half the staff and stuff like this. So I think that was quite a big shock to him, actually. So he did slightly downsize. I mean, it's still a massive operation by anyone else's standards. But the other thing I thought was quite sweet was, okay, here's a guy who's like, I don't know, he's got so much money and he could sort of do what he wanted. But what he chooses to do is to get up in the morning. It's like the Bob Dylan quote. He goes into his studio where I interviewed him. He has one assistant. And actually under lockdown, he had zero assistants and goes home in the evening. And that's what he does. He just paints all day. So he's come back, you know, creates this massive empire with all his staff, and he still has that, but his everyday life, he's happier just to go into a studio. It's like I interviewed David Hockney. He does the same thing. That's what they do. They just work all day, and that's what they want to do. And the money sort of, it is secondary. Obviously he's also got, he can sort of get a private jet to Ibiza or whatever, but the substance of his everyday is going into the studio, painting all day, packing up at 6, going home, having supper and going to bed. You know, it's quite an ordinary life. So I thought that was interesting because actually that aspiration is within reach for almost anybody. It's all right for you. It's all right for Rowan Williams and Damien Hirst, you know. But, you know, we can all, it's all within our reach to, find some sort of work that we sort of more or less enjoy and to get our lives under some sort of control. And that's why I find these people inspiring. But they do, you know, someone like Damon does attract a lot of resentment because he's so successful and, you know, and he's sort of, I don't know, he's not exactly sort of, he doesn't sort of court popularity. But he doesn't really care. So, yeah, going back to what I said originally, I think he's a sort of a free spirit. And I think that's partly why people are attracted to the work, actually. You can sort of, it might look just like a load of spots or butterfly wings or something. But there's something about his exuberance. In his personality, and his love of life that comes through in the art, and then people buy that to get a, you know, to have a little taste of it. So, I mean, I suppose you can't really compare Dickens, but I mean, I'm reading a biography of Dickens. He had this massive exuberance, and he was incredibly successful from a very, very young age. And also very rich, you know. I mean, he sold so many copies. Everyone bought them, and there were cults. There were, you know, there were plays, you know, right from the beginning, with the Pickwick Papers, which was the second book.
Yeah,
he was massive, and you just think, what is it? Some people like the Beatles, Damien. I don't know what it is. You know, that they combine this amazing ability to sort of pump out products,
yeah,
or, you know, artistic creation. But there's something else. There's this sort of love of life that they sort of lift people up and make people feel better. Certainly, I think everyone would agree that the Beatles and Dickens do that. But I think Damien's got a bit of that as well.
And also, again, sort of linking that to, I know you mentioned this sort of the philosophy angle later on. So have you got the sort of Damien Hirst, the sort of the existential hero angle, the sort of Sartre, sort of a Sartrean sort of a freedom sort of ambassador compared to someone who sort of wants to perhaps just have a more is more obsessed with sort of control and autonomy, taking a sort of a lead from Kant. I know that you and also talking about staggering around Soho, staggering around sort of Dean Street in the 90s, obviously Mr. Brett Anderson and Suede. So go on then, what was it like meeting Mr. Anmol Nitrate?
Well, there was quite a good film came out about Suede, actually, and I hadn't quite realised. I was sort of, you know, reasonably big fan. I think I saw them once or twice in the 90s. An amazing stage show, and he wrote some absolutely brilliant songs, and it was a very original sound, actually. But yeah, he was, you know, he's a junkie for some years, I think.
Oh, big time, yeah. They all were. Off the scale. Yeah.
Yeah. And he doesn't seem like that now. He's like a sort of Brian Ferry. I mean, he's incredibly well dressed and super handsome.
Yeah.
You know, we had a party. We gave Brett an award for Idol of the Year for his book, which was his first not part of his memoirs, which is really quite a lovely book.
Yeah, yeah.
Had a bit of a, it's almost like Joe Wharton.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of working class, or D.H. Lawrence, is this sort of beautiful young aesthete, like an Oscar Wilde, born into a working class background.
Yeah, yeah, he had quite a tough child, didn't he? He had a rough old time in wherever, sort of a Croydon, I mean, Crawley, wasn't he? He grew up.
Yeah,
somewhere.
His dad was actually quite. His dad was really into Liszt. I think he was like a massive classical music fan, but they didn't really have any money, and so Brett was longing to escape, a bit like, I don't know, maybe sort of David Bowie or a sort of Susie Sue from Susie and the Banshees, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's how I sort of saw him. And he came to a party we had to present this award. I have to say, all the ladies there were swooning. And he's very, very composed.
Yeah.
He was saying himself, he's extremely vain.
Yeah.
But he's just, you know, again, he's very intelligent. And he's very inquiring. And extremely thoughtful person, reflective. I mean, you know. It was lovely to be able to meet him, and he's now become an Idler fan too. So, I think that sort of, you know, he said in another life he would have liked to have gone to Oxford and done English and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think he sort of feels that, you know, because the Idler's got that sort of literary side, so he's quite pleased to be involved in the whole thing.
Yeah,
And he doesn't really, I think he had a glass of wine, but he sort of, you know, he's just a bit more or less goes to bed early. You know, he's got a family. He lives in Somerset on a farm.
Yeah, yeah.
Or so, I don't know if it's actually a farm. I can't imagine him kind of cleaning out the chickens yet. But.
Yeah, I don't imagine sort of exactly on his tractor, but I know you mean perhaps sort of a stylish farm, sort of whatever, sort of an apparition.
Stylish farm, yeah. But he does apparently sort of go and pick up his children. And I was like, wow, that's, you know, I wonder what he's like on the school run, you know. And he goes, don't worry, I'm quite ordinary. I'm not there sort of slapping my arse and, like, you know, shouting
yeah, exactly.
In a falsetto or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very good. Perhaps you could sort of meet up, if you ever sort of launched your own football side. There's that great piece that Percy Preston wrote a while ago in The Idler about the beautiful game and the Corinthians FC. So there we are. When you have your Idler football team, perhaps he can be in it. Also, there's a great piece I really liked a while ago that Tim Richardson wrote about whatever the art flaneur, talking about Stanley Spence, and they talked about Cookham, the village, and it's a really, really interesting piece just about the sort of the slightly sort of a forgotten, quiet village. But any piece that they didn't put in there was that it was a village in the epic Colin McInnes book, Absolute Beginners, when he talks about the village where Crêpe Suzette, the fantastic sort of a girl in the book's female character, meets up with the he is a man of her dreams, as it were. So one of those, but I'll just mention that as an aside.
Well, that was in Cookham, was it?
Yeah, exactly. An epic bit in that when the hero sort of zooms down to try and meet up the Crêpe Suzette, who's run off with some sort of hideous sort of wealthy guy, and sort of he pleads for her to return and have this amazing sort of emotional meetup. Great book, terrible film.
Well, yeah, I must read it. I'm not even sure if I saw the film, but
oh, it's so bad.
Is it really bad? Yeah.
I mean, it's written. I mean, it couldn't be a clearer screenplay, and yet somehow it was dreadful. one of those.
The Art Flaneur, that was an idea. Tim Richardson is, he's more of a gardens writer, but he's an old friend. He's been around forever, and he's a terrific writer. Mm. And he said, why don't we call it art? And I was like, we want some sort of art coverage. I mean, visual art. And he said, well, what about Art Flaneur? Flaneur is the idea of the sort of 19th century poet wandering around Paris, not really doing anything, just observing.
Yeah,
And we thought, well, that's a lovely name. And so he quite often goes on these trips. So for that one, he did a day out in Cookham, and I think it's a nice, it's quite a fun thing to do as a day out. And his Art Flaneur thing, he also says, what people forget is that you can see a lot of really fantastic art for free in commercial galleries. They look a bit scary, the ones in Cork Street in London, for example.
Yeah,
but the doors are all open, and there's someone in there, he'll show you around, and you just have to stand on the threshold before you go in and close your eyes and say to yourself, I am a millionaire. I am a millionaire.
Exactly.
I am a millionaire. And then you walk in with great confidence, because obviously that's what they're interested in. Is this guy going to buy something?
Precisely.
Because he's amazing. So he says, you don't just pay like 30 quid at the Tate. You can go around the corner and see these Blake etchings for nothing.
Mm. Well, exactly. Or perhaps in terms of walking in with confidence, not purely being a millionaire, but like Widnail Nye being a multi-millionaire.
So multi-millionaires, yeah.
Precisely. Buy this place and shut it down. Talking about trips, I really enjoyed the piece by Flora Neville that she wrote about the old trains that she'd found from sort of like T. Lawrence on Ottoman Empire age old steam trains that were left behind in Tripoli in Lebanon. I mean, I've been to Lebanon quite a few times, and it's such an amazing country, although down in its luck at the moment, to put it mildly. It's just such an interesting piece about these decaying trains up in Tripoli. Fantastic. What about in the last sort of 15 minutes or whatever, and it's been so brilliant talking with you. It's been really, really fascinating. You mentioned at the beginning the Mighty Extinction Rebellion, and obviously you and I have both been sort of met up talking about them at places like the Byline Festival over the last sort of few years with the epic Idler tent there, when I've been sort of loitering around attempting to sort of sell my marvellous books. I mean, Emma Thompson got involved obviously with Extinction Rebellion, particularly in terms of sort of public visibility when they did the Oxford Circus action April last year, which some people liked, some people seriously didn't. So what was it like hanging out with her?
With Emma Thompson?
Yeah.
Yeah, again, I mean...
I just think some really sort of divides opinion, so they're just really interested to see what you're around
to. I know, one of our sub-editors... Emma Thompson. because she thinks, particular sub editor is, I would say, on the right, on the right wing of things. And the Spectator readers and the Rod Littles of this world, they look at someone like Emma Thompson and they think, she's a lovey, she's a do-gooder, she's sort of telling people off about their lifestyle, but she herself has a second home or whatever. I mean, I really don't care about that stuff. I mean, I sort of see it, judge her by her, what she's done, her actions. You know, she's made so many great films. She's written so many great films and books. But more than that, she gave us money.
Excellent.
So, you know, so a few years ago, we just relaunched our magazine, and we decided to raise a fund, so we had some money in the bank to you know, keep us going and employ some staff and do some marketing, get the word out there, and so on.
Yeah, nice.
Because previous to that, business wise, we'd been we'd managed to get things done, but we'd been completely hand to mouth. And anyone who's run a small business knows that's stressful. You know, sort of, are we going to manage to afford to pay the VAT? How about if I move some money from my overdraft, you know, and then we can pay HMRC, you know. But,
yeah, yeah.
I had the advice from John Brown, who made a lot of money out of publishing Viz, among other magazines.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, you really need it's common advice, you need some sort of a cushion in the bank. And I saw some other people doing this sort of crowdfunding equity sale. Which is a pretty horrific process. You know, it's almost like doing a little IPO on your business.
Yeah,
you had to produce massive spreadsheets and forecasts and things, none of which, you know, it's like next year we'll be sort of making £1 million a year or whatever.
Yeah.
So I went around our readers and, you know, Emma Thompson had been, when we opened our shop, she came and opened it. You know, she'd just be very supportive of what we do. And then she put a few grand into our crowdfunding, which was like, you know, so appreciated.
Nice. Yeah.
So I've been hassling her for ages to do an interview and, you know, probably for about 3 or 4 years, and we finally sort of pinned her down, and went for a walk on Hampstead Heath. And yeah, she's just actually a good person, you know. Maybe some of the stuff she does look a bit sort of pious, but to me, you know, she's on the right side of things, and she sets an example. By the way, as well, you know, we hear on the grapevine when she's on a film. She's deliberately cheerful and not difficult. It makes such a difference to all the other people who she's working with, and she sort of sets the tone. And is not shouty and tantrumy, and you know, it's just warm to everybody, you know. And I met her husband, who's really nice, Greg, and I think she's, you know, she's a great person, and she puts up with a lot of shit that's really not fair, in my view. I think her the film that we talked about for the interview was not well reviewed.
Yeah,
it was called Last Christmas, and people said it's the worst film that's ever been made, and things like this. But I think it was. I never saw it, but I think it did pretty well at the box office. It obviously had a lot of charm. It was like a sort of a bit of a Richard Curtis, an attempt to do a sort of a Richard Curtis, I think.
Well, to be described as the worst of all time is fantastic. So, because wear that sort of badge with pride and stick it on the poster. So,
well, also, you know, she could also say, well, you know, that's what the critics said, but the people loved it. So, you know, who
precisely
cares?
There we are. All right. Okay. Well, but for the last few minutes, I thought it'd be interesting just to find out where next for yourselves. So, you know, almost like right back to where we started, and there's a really interesting piece that you did when you you mentioned you'd reprinted, and again I'm quoting yourself back at you here, but whatever, a year or so ago, you said you reprinted a brilliant but little known essay by Aldous Huxley called Time and the Machine, which asserts that we've lost the fine art of doing nothing. So now I know that, I mean, if it hadn't been for this goddamn virus, that only a few days ago the Idler Festival, the mighty Idler Festival, would have been taking place, but obviously it hasn't. So what is going to be happening on the sort of a short to medium term future with yourselves? What's going on?
What we have done instead of our live events, because as you say, thanks, Sean, you know, we 2 years ago we started an annual festival for sort of 400 or 500 people at a lovely house in Hampstead called Fenton House, which is owned by the National Trust and has a really, I mean, it's gorgeous. It's got a massive garden, you know. We've had Michael Palin and Louis Theroux, and then loads of events and talks and music, and I mean, Victoria said it's supposed to be like a sort of your fantasy school, a school that you would actually really, really enjoy going to, with really fun teachers, and you know, and that's what it was like. It was really good, and so yeah, that obviously was like immediately, well, more or less, not immediately, but it was eventually, you know, obviously wasn't going to happen. It was in July, And I've been having a Zoom chat with some old mates. We normally go walking together, so once or twice a year. And so we thought we'd do a couple of Zooms instead. And Victoria overheard it and thought it was, you know, sort of, it was actually quite sort of fun to overhear an interesting chat. Like you said, like overhearing a chat in the pub or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we thought, well, maybe we could do something online then. You know, we'll try Zoom. We did a couple of trial runs with Mark Vernon, who's our sort of idler philosopher, resident philosopher.
Yeah.
He's often on Mull Maze and stuff like that, written loads of books. He's terrific.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was quite fun. And then we invited some guests, and we've been doing that every Thursday evening. And it's been really good. We've got David Graver on Thursday this week. Last week we had Guy Standing, I think. We've had Lucy Cook, who's a writer, a zoologist. And we also had some bigger names like Amanda Iannucci, who was really funny.
Of course.
Yeah, so that's been good. We're hoping to keep that going. I think we're going to skip August. But it's actually been nice, you know. You might say, oh, well, you know, it's much better to, you know, make merry in real life and, you know, get together. You mentioned the Byline Festival. I mean, we love doing festivals every summer. We go to loads of festivals. We've got our own festival.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, as a sort of substitute, it's pretty good because it's global. It's free and anyone can go. So people used to say, oh, well, it's all right for you, but you all live in London. I can't come to any of your events because I live in Chester or York.
Yeah, yeah.
Or indeed, you know, California or actually Australia. Or, you know, we've got people from New Zealand and Finland. I mean, all over the world coming to these things. And so now they can.
Yeah.
So we're sort of quietly optimistic about it, that as a sort of regular thing. So there's that for the future. I mean, we're going to do. We organised a couple of retreats in Italy in September and October, and they're going ahead.
Brilliant.
I guess we'll be doing our festival next year, you know, unless something else happens. But you have to sort of got to be quite fluid these days. It's difficult to plan, isn't it? But you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
As far as the magazine goes, you know, we're going to continue to produce the magazine 6 times a year. We're just working on one now, which comes out in September, October, and that's got Adam Buxton on the cover. He's a brilliant podcaster, as you know, and he's got a book coming out in September, which we're going to be talk about in the interview.
Yeah.
And as far as sort of, we also produce online courses. So we just done one with Roger Phillips, who's the legendary forager. He's about 86 now. Mm-hmm. Written loads of books about foraging. So we filmed him in his garden, you know, teaching us foraging. And that's another element of the business is, you know, we want to sort of teach people. The Idle Academy's subline was the Idle Academy of Philosophy, Husbandry and Merriment. We've sort of done a kind of new version of that slogan, which we're going to hopefully pump out the place, which is slow down, have fun, live well. I'm slightly inspired by the kind of stay at home slogan. As soon as, you know, under coronavirus, we say, you know, stay in bed, save lives. Because it's like, wow,
yeah. This
is the first time that, you know, being idle has been seen as morally good by the authorities. You know, don't do anything. You know, if you do anything, you're evil. So slow down, have fun, live well. You know, slow down is about the philosophy and the thinking. Have fun. Yes, it's all about, you know, we're all about merrymaking and parties, you know, when it's permitted. And if it's not, then yeah, online's not such a bad substitute. And live well, that's, you know, the sort of everyday art of living, and which could be, you know, household management, growing vegetables, whatever it might be, DIY gardening, you know. That's an important part of life, the sort of self-sufficiency skills or whatever you want to call them. I mean, I think husbandry is quite a good name for them. It means care.
Yeah.
You know, looking after yourself, looking after your household, looking after the people that you're with. And, you know, that does include things like shopping. You know, that's an important part of everyday life. And food buying, cooking, preparation. And I think these are important things to look at as well. So we try and cover those three things in the magazine and help people to do those things, to slow down, have fun and live well. And I think the lockdown has you know, in lots of cases, it has helped people to slow down, have fun, and live well, and look at what's important. And, you know, do you need to be rushing about the place? Yeah, you can work at home. You know, I mean, people have been discovering their own neighbourhoods. That certainly happened to us. You know, we were on our bicycles all the time. I live in West London. We were going up and down the river, places we'd never been before, which were just like 10-minute cycle ride away.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been to New York, but I hadn't been to, like, you know, 2 minutes around the corner, like a strand on the green in Hammersmith, which is absolutely beautiful, in Chiswick. And,
yeah.
Unbelievable. We've been kayaking down the river, and, you know. So, so I think that's been a very good lesson, philosophically speaking, to love what you have.
Yeah. Very good. Well, look, that's absolutely amazing, Tom. So thank you so much. So, slow down, have fun, live well. There's a manifesto for all of us. So Tom Hodgkinson, writer, editor of The Idler, philosopher and all-round deep thinker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. That was really fun. Thanks very much indeed. And thanks to everyone else who's tuned in as well.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.